At length burst in the argent revelry with plume, tiara, and all rich array. Numerous as shadows haunting fairily the brain, new stuffed in youth with triumphs gay of old romance. These let us wish away, and turn soul-thoughted to one lady there, whose heart had brooded all that wintry day on love, and winged St. Agnes' saintly care, as she had heard old dames full many times declare. They told her how upon St. Agnes' Eve young virgins might have visions of delight and soft adorings from their loves receive, upon the honeyed middle of the night, if ceremonies due they did aright, as supperless to bed they must retire, and couch supine their beauties lily white, nor look behind, nor sideways, but require of heaven with upward eyes for all that they desire. Full of this whim, the thoughtful Madeline, the music, yearning like a god in pain, she scarcely heard. Her maiden eyes divine, fixed on the floor, saw many a sweeping train pass by. She heeded not at all. In vain came many a tiptoe amorous cavalier and back retired, not cooled by high disdain. But she saw naught. Her heart was otherwhere. She sighed for Agnes' dreams, the sweetest of the year. The Eve of St. Agnes. Welcome to Professing Literature. We are recording in Oklahoma City in the year of grace 2024, and we are glad you're with us. Professing Literature is the podcast where we look closely at a short passage from an important work of literature in the hopes of seeing the writer in action. We aim to work across literary genres and modes, whether comedy or tragedy, drama, poetry or fiction, looking at the dynamics of a passage in order to understand what the author is doing and what is at stake for the work as a whole, the issues that it clarifies, the techniques that are involved. I am David Anderson. I'm a professor of Renaissance Literature at the University of Oklahoma in the Department of Classics and Letters, and I'm here right now with my producer, Mr. Eric Williams. Hello, Eric.
Good evening, David.
Yes, it's dark right now outside, which is not usually when we've tended to record, but we're giving it a whirl tonight, so hopefully we'll have our wits about us, and the adorable little children won't need their dad right now, so we'll see how this goes. It seems like your house is quiet, Eric, and we should be able to carry on without any... interruptions, but I know well enough you can't absolutely take that for granted.
This is true, but we should be okay.
Yeah, sometimes you have the thing of really thinking, okay, they're all asleep, and that's when you get burned by the little steps coming down the stairs.
Yes.
Daddy.
Yeah, or one of them screaming or vomiting in bed.
Yeah, the waking up sick can really put a kink in your evening.
Yeah.
We had that a couple of weeks ago, or last week maybe, and poor little thing, she was okay, but she had an unpleasant 90 minutes or so, and it's not like as a parent you can do whatever you were going to do, whether it was clean the kitchen or read a book or watch television or go to sleep.
Yeah, go to sleep. That's a good one.
You're just on the hook.
Yeah.
At the same thing, I don't know how often in life I do anything that's more valuable than helping one of my sick children, even if it feels like a disruption. If you step back and really think about it, that's probably a better way to spend. Not that you want them to be sick, but as a kind of meaningful activity, that one has to rank pretty high, comforting a sick child.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, we're very pleased you're with us here. by all means, if you haven't done so already, and it's not obnoxious for me to ask, please subscribe to us on your podcast service of choice. Rate us and review us. All of that is very helpful and very encouraging. But I think we'll get down to business because we've got what I realized today when I was sifting through my notes. I think a two-part episode. I think, certainly I could cover some of this poem in one episode, but I thought it might be kind of nice to do two because it is such a magnificent piece of poetry. So we're in the Romantic period, the early 19th century, with John Keats, one of my very favorite poets, and his great poem, The Eve of St. Agnes. So this is a strange poem. There would have been more straightforward Keats choices I could have made. I could have tackled one of the great odes or one or two of his sonnets, and all of that would have been worthwhile. But I've always loved The Eve of St. Agnes, which ranks among his most important poems, although of his very most important poems, it's probably the most difficult for someone who's not really familiar with Keats to kind of find their feet and understand. Although there's plenty of Keats, if I think about it, things like Lamia, that you could say that of also. But The Eve of St. Agnes is a longish poem. It's not an epic or anything like it. We're talking about 10 or a dozen pages, but it's long enough that it demands some patience. And I hope I'm approaching it right now in a way that doesn't merely give a synopsis of it, because of course that's not what we do here, but nevertheless kind of gives you, the listener, a strong sense of what's going on and maybe whets your appetite to read it. So John Keats is one of the great pillars of the English Romantic movement in literature. Romanticism is a kind of pan-European movement that gathers steam in the dying days of what we tend to think of or tend to call the Enlightenment. And so the figure early on who we maybe most associate with the Romantic movement, although he became ambivalent about the idea, is Goethe of Germany, who's really the essential figure of the era, but one who's difficult to categorize over the course of his long career. But when we talk about English Romanticism, we are talking about one of the major and most enduring periods of English literary history. And you could roughly think of it as sort of, 50 years, if you're being generous, from sometime in the 1780s, when William Blake is starting to gather momentum, to sometime in the 1820s. So 1780s to 1820s. Traditionally, scholars would talk about the six great Romantic poets, and they all are great, and they're deserving of that distinction. It's often broken down into the first generation of Romantic poets: Blake, Wordsworth, and Coleridge. Wordsworth and Coleridge were friends and collaborators, not always very friendly friends, but friends and collaborators. Blake is doing his own entirely idiosyncratic thing, but his genius is so undeniable, and his affinity for at least parts of what we think of as Romanticism is clear enough that he's given a place in that first generation. And then there's the second generation of Lord Byron, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and John Keats. Keats is the youngest of these poets, and he dies, unfortunately for us, in 1821, at the very young age of 25. There's not a figure in English literary history who had done more genuinely great work at that age than Keats. Milton had shown some indications of his promise by that age, although nothing on the level with what Keats accomplished. And Shakespeare, we don't know about at age 25. That's in the period that we sometimes refer to as the lost period or the lost years in Shakespeare's life. He would turn 25, what, in 1589? And so within a couple of years, probably, of that birthday, he'd show up in London and eventually start to find his feet in the world of the London theater. But he had not done anything at that point that has survived to us. And so Keats is a special figure, and we can only wonder, you know, maybe he would have sort of burned out his genius by the time of his 28th or 30th birthday had he lived, but maybe he would not have. I should mention that distinction of those six great figures of English Romanticism is today a questionable one. There are other very worthy poets who in their day in that period were extremely popular. Female poets, Anna Letitia Barbauld, Felicia Hemans, Felicia Dorothea Hemans. There was Robert Southey, who was in that day sometimes seen on the same kind of level as Wordsworth and Coleridge. There's John Clare, the peasant poet. Among all of that list, I, for my money, would take Keats. I love Keats. And that's not necessarily because he chimes with me in the way some other authors do. It's probably no big secret to listeners of this podcast that I have an affinity for, you know, not exclusively, but a strong affinity for writing that reflects or is interested in or involved with the Judeo-Christian tradition. That's what I tend to be most interested in and maybe most strongly inclined towards. And if you keep on listening, I'm sure we'll cover many figures who fit within that. Keats does not, by any means. And so today's poem is maybe a little bit different in spirit from most of what we've looked at over the few years we've been doing the podcast. But it is an absolute masterpiece. Keats is known for elaborate diction. He is not interested in the sort of plain-spoken poetry that Wordsworth had made his mark in the generation earlier. Wordsworth's effort was to sort of return English poetry, or at least much of his poetry was in this direction, returning it to ideas of simplicity and directness of speech. And almost a kind of plainness, a plainness where the beauty is apparent and where the ideas can be very rich. But Wordsworth sought simplicity in his language and in his figures. And Keats very much does not. Keats writes with the greatest sensuality of any major writer in English. He's interested in ornamentation verbally and richness. That's what he likes in the images he presents to us. You already would have gotten a whiff of all this from the three stanzas I read at the beginning of the episode. But that's what Keats is aiming for. He has poems that are more plainly and directly written than The Eve of St. Agnes is. It would almost be impossible to write a poem that wasn't, or that was, even for him, on the equal of The Eve of St. Agnes when it comes to its verbal adornment. But he never gets very simple. He was a poor boy growing up in Greater London, the son of an ostler, a man who took care of horses, who died when Keats was young. And his life, for those of you who know it, is marked by tragedy. He dies of that favorite disease of Europeans in the 19th century, consumption, tuberculosis. At that young age, he had already nursed his brother through his death of tuberculosis. I believe his father died in an accident. His mother may have been carried off by TB, although someone will have to look that up for themselves, because I can't recall off the top of my head. He had fallen in love with a girl named Fanny Braun and proposed marriage to her and was accepted, but he died before they could marry. He realized the danger he was in. Keats, fascinatingly, was trained as a surgeon as a teenager. That's not as lofty a career in the early 19th century as it is today. A surgeon was often distinguished from a physician who had university education, because a surgeon was more rough and ready. So you had to have training, of course, but it was not the kind of training that a medical doctor in the period would have received. And so Keats would have had some very grim experiences as a very young man, taking part or observing surgeries and the dissection of cadavers and things like that. And so it's all the more striking, or perhaps quite understandable, that his poetry would move away from that kind of gritty perspective on life towards the beautiful. And beauty, of course, was his great obsession. William Butler Yeats, coming along towards the end of the 19th century, pictured Keats once as a little boy with his face pressed against a sweet shop window, staring at the beautiful, gorgeous treats inside with longing. And so Yeats captures in that image a sense of Keats as defined by a kind of unsatisfied longing, where his working class origins are contrasted with the style he develops and with his intense love of beauty. It was only towards the end of his life. Keats, of course, never attained fame in his lifetime as a poet. He's a little bit like Vincent van Gogh as an artist, creating works of genius, recognized for his talent by a few insiders and fellow professionals, but completely unknown to the public, or almost entirely unknown to the public. But that after his death, very quickly, his work began to be read and then championed, and his greatness eventually seen. So it's only in the last couple of years of his life that he wrote most of the poems that we treasure today. Most of those are in the last collection of poetry he wrote, his Lamia volume. And St. Agnes, The Eve of St. Agnes, our poem, is included in that volume. It's written at the same time as the great odes that are his most familiar poems, Ode to a Nightingale and Ode on a Grecian Urn being the most famous. La Belle Dame sans Merci, his gorgeous ballad, and some of his greatest sonnets. Percy Shelley, who was, if not a friend, at least friendly with Keats, drowned a little while after Keats died off the western coast of Italy. And when Shelley's body was found, he had the Lamia volume of Keats in his pocket, which is a very powerful thing to think about. The Eve of St. Agnes is unique. It's unique in the story Keats tells, in the invitation to the reader to not figure out the story so much as to simply experience it, which is something many poets want from their readers, but few demand it as assertively as Keats seems to do here. It's unique for its form, or if not unique, at least unusual. Keats, and this is something, if we were in the classroom and I had a whiteboard and we all sort of had our copies of the poem in front of us, it might be easier to bring home. But Keats writes this poem in what is known as the Spenserian stanza. The Spenserian stanza is a kind of poetic stanza that was invented by Edmund Spenser, another of the, you know, essential figures in the history of English poetry. Spenser, writing in the late 16th century, a contemporary of Shakespeare's, undertakes his great work, his epic romance, The Faerie Queen, allegorical epic romance, by inventing a stanza that has borne his name ever since. And this is what Keats uses. And not very many poets have taken it up, at least not many of the sort of most noted, most remarked upon, most famous English poets. It's a hard thing to write in. And it's a kind of stanza that demands a very particular subject. It works beautifully for the Faerie Queen, and it works beautifully for this. It works beautifully. What's Tennyson's poem in the Spenserian stanza? The Lotus Eaters, if I'm not mistaken. So it can be done, but it's not often tried. And Keats is a practitioner who does things with this stanza that only Spenser himself equals. So if you're not familiar with poetry or deeply familiar with poetry, you might wonder why I'm yammering on about this. I'll tell you, first of all, what the Spenserian stanza is. It's a 9-line stanza. So stanzas can be short or they can be longer. 9 lines is a fairly long stanza. It has a very complex rhyme scheme. There are 3 or 4 rhyming words, I can't remember which, let's say 3 rhyming words in a Spenserian stanza. It's written in iambic pentameter. So the meter, the da-dum-da-dum-da-dum-da-dum-da-dum meter that we most associate with Shakespearean tragedy and with Milton's Paradise Lost. So 10 syllables to a line. At length burst in the argent revelry. 10 syllables to a line that are mostly organized in terms of, well, as I say, da-dum, 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 da-dum. Although poets play with that and vary it and are never perfectly consistent with their iambics. But in other words, you have an unstressed syllable followed by a stressed syllable. And so that's the line of English poetry that is most often used. It's said that it best captures the qualities of English language, of the English language as a spoken language, because our language is a heavily stressed language. We have a lot of internal rhythm to our language, a lot of natural up and down to it. So it's not merely a matter of 10 syllables, but rather 10 syllables divvied up into what are known as 5 feet. So 5 metrical units, da-dum. But the last line of each stanza, in the Spenserian stanza, you have 8 lines of iambic pentameter with this very formal rhyme scheme. And then you have a line written not in pentameter, but iambic hexameter. So you have a 12-syllable line. Didum, 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 didum. Pardon me. Didum, 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 didum. So you have an extra foot, as it's known. And if you listen closely, you'll catch this while I'm reading, that the last line of each stanza is a longer line. Gives a feeling sometimes of languor to the stanza, that things are slowing down, which gives it a feeling of concluding. Or even if there's not languor, a feeling of sort of comfortable slowness, it provides a kind of cap, a frame to the stanza. And so that gives these stanzas the feeling of being really, more than in many other forms of stanzaic poetry, a feeling of really being self-enclosed units. And so for a poet like Spenser or Keats working in this mood, it's perfect because it allows the poet to come at the subject and talk about an aspect of the subject, whether it's a story or an individual or an idea or something, and sort of give us a feeling of going through it in some depth in a single self-enclosed unit. And then the 12-syllable line, the Alexandrine, as it's known, brings this feeling of closure. And then we reset. And it's not just merely a matter for a good poet of just continuing to rush on with the same idea. But now he sort of stops and clears his throat and resets and approaches the subject anew. He's continuing on to it in a new phase. This is a kind of poetry that's very different from, say, Paradise Lost, which is written in verse paragraphs, as we would call them, just long stretches of continuous iambic pentameter, and then Milton will reach a point where he'll sort of give us a new verse paragraph. But the flow in poetry like that, you know, it's less interrupted, and things develop more sort of smoothly or organically, ideally. Or else, if it's an unideal poem, then we may have the feeling of just getting lost and being burned out and running out of gas. With this kind of poetry organized in these 9-line stanzas, we have this feeling of reset. And so a good poet knows that, and he uses these stanzas as containers for sort of sub-ideas or sub-components of what it is he's telling us in the overall story. And Keats does this, if I'm fortunate, I'll be able to bring this out a little bit, but Pete Keats does this with extraordinary artfulness. So that's just a note about the structure of this poem. The subject is an odd one. It is the story of 2 lovers who find one another in a castle and mutually recognize their love and then run away. They escape into the night. And Keats tells this story over 42 stanzas, 42 of these Spenserian stanzas. The title refers to the fact that the poem is set on the 20th of January, which is the Feast of St. Agnes. St. Agnes was a martyr during the Roman persecution of the church, and she became the patron saint of virgins and young girls. And there were various legends, certainly in the British Isles, maybe beyond them, surrounding, and this is going back to the medieval period, various legends surrounding the power of St. Agnes to allow maidens to see their future husbands on her saint's day, her feast day. This is not a tradition that the official church had much interest in promoting. It's a folk tradition that grows up around her feast day. The idea that if a maiden woman wants to have a vision or a dream of her future husband, she has to follow a certain protocol on the eve of St. Agnes and go to bed in a certain way. And if she does everything correctly, she will, or she may at least, be given this vision of her future husband. There are various ways in which the rituals the young woman is supposed to do are construed historically. In Keats's story, and you got this in the opening burst of poetry at the top of the episode, in Keats's story, the young woman is to go to bed without supper, so she is to undertake at least a small fast. It's a feast day, but she, because of what she's asking the saint for, has to go to bed without supper. She has to not look behind her as she goes to her bed and retires for the night, undresses, at least to some extent. It's not entirely clear maybe quite how much the young lady in this poem undresses, but she has to prepare herself for bed without ever once looking behind her. She has to do what Orpheus could not do in the legend, the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, when he is given the unprecedented opportunity to bring his bride back from the dead to the land of the living. Hades tells him that because of the greatness of the music Orpheus performs for Hades and the poignancy of the song he sings, Hades gives him permission to bring Eurydice back to life up out of the underworld. But the condition is that he not look behind him as she walks, following him. And of course, the tragic end of the myth is that he hears a noise or some such, just as he's almost about to get back to the world of the living. And he sort of reflexively turns and he sees Eurydice being pulled back away from him down into Hades. And so he was given this opportunity, but he failed. So there's a little bit of that with the way Keats imagines the St. Agnes Eve ritual that the young woman undertakes. She can't look behind her. That fact is going to prove extremely convenient for another party in the poem. The framing of the story is something Keats also does extremely well. This entry into the castle by the young man Porphyro and the eventual finding of the beloved and the escape from the castle, the sense of danger and urgency is heightened because he gives us, as background, a Romeo and Juliet story of warring families, that this boy and this girl who have had their hearts somehow to some degree awakened by one another before this meeting, they are forbidden to love each other because the two families in this vaguely medieval landscape that Keats presents hate one another. There's a blood feud. And so if the young man is caught in this castle, he's a dead man. And so he has to sneak into the castle to woo her. He has one friend in the castle. We don't quite know how, but it's the old woman, Angela, who is conveniently Madeline's servant. And so she helps him get inside and get positioned to where he will be able to approach her or perhaps accost her She is terrified, but she sneaks him into Madeline's room so that he can watch Madeline enter the room and retire for the night. And then when Madeline has fallen asleep, as he's watching from her closet, and remember, she can't turn around, so, you know, she, in obedience to the dictates of this rite, she won't turn around, so there's not much danger of her getting a look at him peering through the closet at her. He comes out of the closet while she's sleeping. He lays out a feast, so he must have been carrying a picnic basket on this frigid January trek across the moorlands. He lays out a feast for her, and then he sings her awake. And so she sees him. She doesn't know, at first at least, to what extent he is a dream vision given to her or a real person. Eventually she finds out it's the latter. But he's able to have this encounter with her. And so she has attained what she wanted, only in a much more real sense than the average practitioner of this ritual generally does. The poem is, you know, that idea of Orpheus not being able to resist turning and looking back, but Madeline being able to resist it, is very, very Keatsian, if that's not a strange or kind of corny thing to say. Madeline successfully undergoes this rite, and in doing so, she attains what she wanted, as I said, only she attains it in fullness. And it is Porphyro in the room with her. She, in other words, is content with mystery, to use one of Keats's phrases. And that is very much what the poem is about. If you can say in a kind of sharp, hard way that it is about anything rather than simply a pure experience, which is possibly what Keats would prefer, Madeline's willingness to not look behind her, but to pursue her vision, is an action, a set of mind that is very close to how Keats understands our experience of the beautiful, and also what he understands literature demanding from us. When he realizes that Angela, this old servant, knows what Madeline is going to do. He's shown up at the castle, not really, attempting to win a bride for himself, but not really fully aware of the context. Porphyro is described by Keats as looking at her like puzzled urchin on an aged crone who keepeth closed a wondrous riddle book. So she has some knowledge, he knows she does, and he wants it. But that line sort of sets the tone for the whole story, one of mystery, the mystery of this experience. And that's an idea that Keats was in love with. Some of you may know of Keats's theory, if you can call it that, of negative capability, which is one of the really brilliant insights, I think, in the history of English literary criticism. Keats was a fantastic letter writer. He wrote letters that have been preserved, probably the most important ones, or many of them at least, to his brothers, George and Tom, and to other friends. And his letters are so chock full of insight and spirit. They're really, really wonderful. And so in one of his most famous letters to his brother, he captures or he describes what he calls negative capability. And so I'll read the letter. He's talking sort of by the by about a conversation he recently had with a friend called Dilk. And as he's doing that, he describes an impression he has about literature to his brother. I can't remember if it's his brother George or his brother Tom. I think it's George. I think Tom was the one who predeceased him. I could be wrong about that. So much for preparation. So he says to his brother, "I had not a dispute, but a disquisition with Dilk upon various subjects. Several things dovetailed in my mind." So in other words, in this conversation, it helped him bring some things together. "And at once it struck me what quality went to form a man of achievement," a phrase that he capitalizes, a man of achievement, "especially in literature. and which Shakespeare possessed so enormously. I mean negative capability. So this is his coining of the term, and now he's going to explain it. So he's saying that great writers, Shakespeare in particular, possess negative capability. That is, he says, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So negative capability is when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So when someone has the capacity to experience the mystery, rather than trying to anatomize it, pin it down, figure it out, diagnose it, whatever appropriate metaphor, to solve or resolve it. Rather, Keats prizes the author who is able to simply present mystery as experience to the reader without asserting, say, a moral. Coleridge, he says, for instance, referring to Samuel Taylor Coleridge of the previous generation, who's in his lifetime regarded as one of the major men of letters, as both a poet and an essayist and a sort of philosopher. Coleridge, for instance, would let go by a fine isolated verisimilitude caught from the penetralium of mystery, from being incapable of remaining content with half knowledge. So Coleridge has the poetic genius, Keats suggests, to create a gorgeous moment within his poetry, but is unable to refrain from exactly specifying what it is that's going on and explaining it. And if you explain something, you explain it away. You resolve the mystery, and so it's no longer a mystery. But Keats says, give us an author like Shakespeare, who elsewhere, he says, can create, you know, an Iago figure, this figure of pure evil, but not be sort of whispering in our ear, you know, this is why Iago's bad, this is why Iago's... You know, Shakespeare is simply able to create these situations and these characters without moralizing us into a fixed understanding of what it is he's doing, but to simply present the theatrical experience for us to get lost in. And the uncertainty we sometimes feel within a Shakespearean play, classic example would be, what is Hamlet's motivation? Why is he unable to act in obedience to the ghost's command? Shakespeare doesn't give us a clear answer to that. He leaves it to us to perhaps infer one, or better still, from Keats's perspective, not to infer one, but just to be captivated by the story. Coleridge, Keats says, can't do that. And so this idea of negative capability is, I hope, a useful one for appreciating what Keats is trying to create in this most enigmatic of stories. I don't know about you, but as the father of daughters, I don't love the idea of a young teenager, however much conviction he has, creeping into my house at night and setting up a feast in my daughter's bedroom. Keats isn't interested in the morality of it, which is not to say that he's saying that there aren't moral problems, perhaps, in what Porphyro and even Madeline do in this situation, but that he's not editorializing to us or explaining the way in which we should understand this story. He's not necessarily telling us they'll live happily ever after at the end of it, or that it's a good thing Porphyro did it, or that this is the correct way for beloved and lover to act on the eve of St. Agnes. He's telling a story, and he wants us to get lost in the beauty of the story, rather than to reduce it to one or another moral axioms. And so he wants to be the poet who is capable of being in uncertainties and doubts without reaching after facts. And he wants to give us, the reader, a poem, or the readers, a poem that invites us to do the same thing. He says elsewhere that for a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration. And I said earlier that beauty is really Keats's watchword. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know, is how the Ode on a Grecian Urn famously ends, that the experience of beauty is at the heart of the human experience, and if there is such a thing as truth, that truth can be accessed through beauty. And poetry should not be, from his perspective, subject to reason. He writes in another letter, a letter to his friend Benjamin Bailey, another a brilliantly insightful sort of throwaway comment that also might be useful here and is in the same family of ideas. He's talking about the imagination. And he says, the imagination may be compared to Adam's dream. He awoke and found it true. Now, he's drawing here not primarily on the book of Genesis, but on John Milton's Paradise Lost. As Milton tells the story, or he has Adam tell the story, to the archangel Raphael, of being put to sleep by God and understanding in a dream, or in a dream seeing Eve drawn from his side, because of course God makes Eve out of one of Adam's ribs and creates her, this creature of pure beauty and joy that he immediately falls in love with in his dream. And then he awakes and he finds Eve. And that this was both a dream and something that was also true. And Keats says it's the imaginative function that works that way. And you can think about how that works exactly various ways. Within this poem, it's very clear because Madeline goes to sleep. We don't know exactly what she's dreaming about. Supposedly, she's dreaming about her husband. Perhaps she hasn't even had a chance to get into her REM state and has not dreamed at all. But she wakes up and finds he's really there. We are left wondering, well, is that the one Madeline really dreamed about? Presumably. Does she really love him? Presumably, because she doesn't flip out and kick him out of her bedroom. But her experience of sleeping and then waking to this reality where Porphyro is embodied before her is a perfect illustration of this idea that Keats so values. So what are we going to do in the remainder of our time? Well, I've kind of decided to approach this poem by not going top to bottom. It's too long a poem for that. But by zeroing in on four pairs of stanzas, and using these four stanzas out of a grand total of 42 to sort of help me tell the story and help us understand the poem. So in this episode, because I've given you such a long lead-in with Keats and Keatsianism, I'm only going to focus on the first two stanzas, stanzas 1 and 2, which introduce the poem. And then I may say another word or two, or I may not, about the passage I opened with. And then I will save for a later episode my final three pairs of stanzas. So that's how we will go about our business today. So I'm going to read to you the stanzas that open the poem, and then we'll talk about them. So these are the opening two stanzas of The Eve of St. Agnes by John Keats. St. Agnes' Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. The owl, for all his feathers, was a cold. The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass, and silent was the flock in woolly fold. Numb were the beadsman's fingers, while he told his rosary, and while his frosted breath, like pious incense from a censer old, seemed taking flight for heaven without a death. Past the sweet virgin's picture, while his prayer, he saith. His prayer, he saith, this patient, holy man, then takes his lamp, and riseth from his knees, and back returneth meager, barefoot, wan, along the chapel aisle by slow degrees. The sculptured dead on each side seem to freeze, imprisoned in black purgatorial rails. Knights, ladies, praying in dumb oratories, he passeth by, and his weak spirit fails to think how they may ache in icy hoods and mails. So there are our first two stanzas. Let's dig into them a little bit. So this little passage is so wonderful at conveying the sense of bone-cracking cold. That's where we begin. St. Agnes Eve, so at the very beginning, Keats announces when this is. And that day, of course, is the 20th of January, which is probably on average about as cold as any day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere. St. Agnes Eve, ah, bitter chill it was. One of the things we can note right at the outset is that these stanzas are going to form such a strong contrast in so many ways. That's what makes them so powerful and so interesting. They form this strong contrast with what follows. Because what follows, for the most part, we come into this castle space, which is a space of luxury. On this night, there is a great feast at this castle. Madeline's family is throwing a party. Porphyro's family, of course, are not invited because they are hated enemies. But there's a great feast at this castle, full of food and wine and revelry and dancing and all things beautiful and luxurious. And then we follow Madeline into her boudoir, which is the sort of epicenter of beauty and luxury. And all of it is, in a sense, made more potent by the fact that we begin in this space of darkness and solitude and, above all, cold. And so the cold, which quite naturally can be expected this time of year, is emphasized so strongly here. And so we have this contrast of austerity that's set up with the later sensuality. And the cold is the most marked symbol of this austerity, but it's not the only one. So we're told at the beginning on this bitterly cold day that the owl for all his feathers was a cold. The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass, and silent was the flock in woolly fold. So the owl is freezing in its feathers. The hare can barely make its way through the frozen grass, which is a great image. This animal, almost incapacitated by the level of the cold and unable to make its way through this grass that is stiff with cold. And silent was the flock in woolly fold. So the sheep are not baaing or moving around at all in their fold. They're simply huddled. So the chill is brought home to us through these three images from the natural world, where these animals that are all, you know, generally understood as pretty hardy when it comes to winter. The owl, we're told, for all his feathers, in spite of all those feathers, he's cold. And the flock in woolly fold, you know, what should be better prepared for the cold than a sheep with its full fleece in the winter? Well, these sheep are simply huddled together, barely enduring the cold. And then we're introduced to this figure called the beadsman, which is a personage that we don't so much note today. A beadsman is a figure from medieval Christianity. It's generally a poor man, often an old man, or you could have a beadswoman, but a poor older person who is given a sort of kind of charity late in his life, generally late in his life, in recognition of the fact that he can't perhaps be doing very much physically. He is given alms, he is given money with the understanding that he will pray rosaries for his patron, for whoever gave him the money. And some beadsmen would have multiple patrons. And so the way the beadsman prays is with a rosary. Now, the rosary is an object and a form of prayer that goes deep into Catholic and Orthodox Christianity and was certainly important in the Middle Ages. Most of you will probably have some understanding of what it means to pray a rosary. You have this object, this set of beads strung together, a set number of beads, 50-odd, I think, 50-odd, 60-odd, if I'm remembering. And those beads are there because they allow you to keep track of, to keep count of your prayers. And so for each bead, you pray a specific prayer. Generally, it's the Hail Mary, although it's punctuated. I think every decade's worth of Hail Marys is punctuated by the Lord's Prayer, a Paternoster. And these prayers, it's understood, can be sort of donated by the prayer on behalf of the prayee, the patron for whom he's praying. So if you're a wealthy man who's maybe put together a sort of mixed record in your time on earth, religiously speaking, you maybe have anxieties in facing the next world and are uncomfortable with the idea of how much time in purgatory you might have to do until you can finally be let out. One of the things that can speed you out of purgatory are the prayers of others. And so you might commission someone to say such prayers for you. And now it's not as crude as it seems. You are giving an alms. You are giving a gift of charity to a poor person to initiate this commission. And then they are, it's not supposed to be seen as a transactional quid pro quo, although it's understandable that some would see it that way. But they are in return doing, you know, possibly for years, for the remainder of their life, these acts of charity for you in praying these rosaries on behalf of your soul. So the prayers they're saying as they go through the Hail Mary over and over and over again, they are supposed to be meditating on mercy for your soul. And this will speed you out of that penitential season of your existence when you're suffering the pains of purgatory as a way of counteracting the misdeeds in your life and preparing your soul for heaven. Needless to say, this is not a form of piety that has much purchase in the Protestant world, and Keats's world is a Protestant world. Keats is not at all religious himself, and he doesn't have a higher opinion of Protestantism, really, than he does of Catholicism. But he's in an English context, especially in an early 19th century English context, he's giving us this picture of piety that he emphasizes and he expects the reader to understand as being a sort of rote, deadened, lifeless piety. Now, I am not suggesting that that is what it is, but Keats is. And his English audience, for the most part, Catholics probably make up less than 5% of the population of England at the turn of the 19th century. His English audience is not generally going to be forearmed with a high opinion of medieval Catholic piety. And so, to a certain extent, he'll be preaching to the choir, but he really doesn't care about religious distinctions. What he's suggesting is that we have this old man, almost drained of life by the end of the poem. We'll see just how drained. And he's saying these prayers. But what Keats suggests is that he's a kind of figure of pity. Notice how he begins to introduce the character by saying, numb were the beadsman's fingers while he told his rosary. And that is, you know, it's kind of old-fashioned phrasing, but to tell a rosary is to pray through it and to go bead by bead. And so the beadsman's fingers, it's so cold. You know, this maybe doesn't strike us because he's just been talking about how cold it is, but he says the beadsman's fingers are numb on the rosary, as though to suggest the beadsman's piety, his devotion, his spiritual act is an act that is numbed and deadened. We're told in the next line that his frosted breath, it's so cold that even in the chapel, his breath is, you know, we can see or we're invited to imagine his breath coming out as he prays. Keats says, it's like pious incense from a censer old. or like pious incense from a censer old, seemed taking flight for heaven. So that word like sets us on alert because he's saying, okay, the beadsman's breath as he prays looks like it's floating up to heaven the way incense floats from a censer that will be swung in a church service, in a Catholic or Orthodox or High Anglican church service. Incense will be used partly just for the sweetness of the fragrance during a special service, but also because of biblical language that talks about how prayer rises up to God like incense and smells sweet to him. And so his frosted breath is compared to incense from a censer, but we have these words like and seemed. It seemed taking flight for heaven without a death. So it doesn't need a death for this prayer to ascend to heaven the way incense is supposed to ascend to heaven. But that word seemed in particular makes us think that it just sort of looks that way, but that's not really what is happening here. It seemed taking flight for heaven without a death, and then the Alexandrine passed the sweet virgin's picture while his prayer he saith. So the incense goes up. He's kneeling before a picture of the virgin, and the incense is going up. But from Keats's perspective, the Virgin Mary is not the virgin he's concerned with in this poem. And so the beadsman is praying before the icon of the Virgin Mary, asking her to intercede to God and to her son on behalf of sinners. But from Keats's perspective, it's the wrong virgin. The one we're going to be interested in the poem is not the virgin of devotion, and especially of the beadsman's devotion. It's Madeline. And so the beadsman is already, five lines in, being positioned as a figure of sort of genuine devotion. Keats isn't exactly saying that he's a fraud or anything like that, the way some anti-Catholic propaganda might suggest. Keats isn't suggesting that the beadsman isn't sincere in his prayers, but he is suggesting that those prayers are ineffectual and perhaps sort of wrong-headed, because Keats certainly can't understand piety like this, and he uses it at the beginning of the poem to offer this very strong contrast, as I said, to what's going to happen within. He continues on, his prayer, he saith, this patient holy man. So he gives approving descriptors to the beadsman, calling him patient and holy, although patience and holiness are not what he's interested in this poem. It may mean that the beadsman is not a hypocrite, so good for him, but Porphyro is neither patient nor holy. But the beadsman says his prayer, then he takes his lamp and riseth from his knees and back returneth meager, barefoot, wan. So his fingers are numb on the rosary, his physical numbness suggesting a kind of spiritual numbness. Just like the owl can't keep warm for all its feathers, the beadsman can't keep his hands warm on his rosary. And then you have these lines about how Keats doesn't just say he walks up the chapel aisle. It says he back returneth. Obviously, the beadsman, in order to go up the aisle, had to at one point go down the aisle. He wasn't beamed down there. When Keats says that he back returneth, meager, barefoot, wan, it gives us this image of regression and his poverty, which is supposed to be exemplary because it's tied to genuine humility and genuine devotion, is here figured as a kind of poverty of the spirit. His feet are bare, perhaps because he's poor, but more likely because he's undertaking barefootedness as a kind of penitential thing, you know, that he's suffering on behalf of others, so he's eschewing footwear. But he makes his way along the chapel aisle by slow degrees. So he's sort of, cold as he is, he's broken and ancient and almost immobilized. As he goes up the chapel aisle, he's in a medieval chapel, and so Keats describes what you would have in medieval chapels. And if you go to a medieval chapel on the European continent or in the British Isles, you'll see plenty of examples of this. But the great and the powerful in the Middle Ages and beyond could, of course, be buried not only in the churchyard outside the church, but within the church. They might be buried under the flagstones of the church. But they might, if they had enough prominence and enough money, be buried in a stone sarcophagus that sits at the side of the church. And there might be, depending on the church, a solid handful of these sarcophagi. Medieval sarcophagi sometimes had on their huge lids carvings or brass reliefs or something like that, meant to emulate the person or to depict the person who was inside the sarcophagus in their coffin. And so you could have a knight, someone who in life had been a knight of the 12th or 13th century, and when he's buried in a sarcophagus with a carved image of himself, perhaps in armor, lying on the sarcophagus. So a depiction of the person within, and you know, generally a kind of idealized depiction as they would want to have been remembered. And so as he recesses up the aisle, having said his prayers in this deadening cold, he passes what Keats called the sculptured dead. So these figures that are sculpted flanking him as he's going up the aisle, the poet says, seem to freeze. Now, of course, the sculptured dead aren't moving because the bodies inside the sarcophagi are dead and the sculptures on their lids are sculptures, not living people. But the sculptures seem to freeze. Now, this is the beadsman's impression I think we're getting, but it's a telling one, that the cold seems to have gotten to them, to these sculptures. And he goes on and says they are imprisoned in black purgatorial rails, presumably because they're railed off from the church as they sit against the walls of the church. But that's very potent language. So the beadsman seems to have the impression that these dead figures are frozen, and also that they're imprisoned, and not just that they're imprisoned, but that they're imprisoned in behind purgatorial rails. Now, of course, liberating souls from purgatory is exactly what the beadsman is supposed to be doing. But his impression of the dead as he goes up the chapel aisle is that they are trapped, as though his prayers are impotent. Now, it's not that a beadsman has sure and certain knowledge of timelines in purgatory and things like that, and sentences in purgatory can be pretty long, much longer than the life of an old man who might be praying. But his impression here seems to contradict his vocation. He passes, the poet says, knights, ladies, praying in dumb oratories, he passeth by. So I think this is to say that as he passes by them, he is praying to himself for them, but he's praying in dumb oratories. And so, fair enough, he's not praying aloud. He's praying kind of internally, but perhaps mouthing the words. But it's almost as though those prayers are kind of neutered or effete and not meaningful because they seem frozen. They seem purgatorially imprisoned. He passeth by, and then we're told, to make it absolutely clear, his weak spirit fails to think how they may ache in icy hoods and mails. Hoods and chainmail being the garb that many of these knights would be depicted in these sculptures. So his spirit is a weak spirit. He is not being presented to us as some kind of lion-hearted champion of traditional piety. he's being presented to us as a failure. Because what contrasts him, what follows him, will be where the poet's interest is. And he's being set up as a kind of ineffective, representative of a regime that the poem is not going to be bound by. Porphyro and Madeline are going to flee this world by the end of the poem. And it's not because they've got two tickets to Disneyland and are going to live happily ever after, as I said, but they're going to face the outside world together at the end of the poem, alive, very much alive, at least for the time being. While the beadsman seems to be trapped, Keats suggests, in a kind of living death, a death whose symbol is the darkness and especially the cold, and who seems to not have a kind of spiritual conviction in him that would validate his piety from the poet's perspective. And so, as he passes by the sculptured dead praying in his dumb oratories, he doesn't think of how they are eventually going to be liberated from purgatory into perpetual bliss. He rather thinks of how cold they must be, about how they're imprisoned, about how they're frozen, about how they must be aching from the coldness in their icy hoods and mails. So far, Keats has given us two stanzas of what might be a poem about any number of things, but might be a poem about the beadsman, the life of the chapel, we don't know what. But very quickly, he's going to swing us in another direction. And so I'll save most of that for the next episode when we really get into the story of Madeline and Porphyro. For now, I'll just take a brief look at the three stanzas that I quoted at the top of the episode, which come fairly early in the poem, only a couple of stanzas, two or three stanzas after the ones I read. But already, the mood and the atmosphere are very different. And so, having given us this picture of the beadsman as this sort of defeated figure, we then move inside the castle to where everything is light and music and feasting and revelry. And so he describes the argent revelry, the silver-plumed, tiarad revelry in their gorgeous clothes, pouring into something like a great hall. He compares them to shadows that haunt the brain, haunting fairly, wonderful phrase, the brain. They are young. They are triumphant. They are gay. They are figures of romance. So all of a sudden within the castle, we're given this gorgeous presentation of life and light and activity and desire and desirability. And then he says, forget about them, we're going to focus. Then let us wish away. These let us wish away, so forget about them. We're going to just look at one lady. And we are told this young lady has not been thinking about the dance and the feast, but has been thinking about loved and winged St. Agnes' saintly care. This could be, if we have only that line, this could be the setup to describing the intense devotion of Madeline, but it's not her devotion that fixes her thoughts on St. Agnes, whose feast day it is. It's rather the promise of what she has heard, Keats says, the old dames, the old wives tell her, which is what a young woman can experience on St. Agnes' Eve if she follows this folk ritual. So the old dames, the next stanza tells us, have informed her that on the eve of St. Agnes, young virgins can have these visions. And it's in this stanza, as we know, you've already heard it, that Keats describes the process there to follow. The thing they have to do in order to receive their love upon the honeyed middle of the night. So contrast already what we know of Madeline's night as she looks forward to it, having this spectacular, sweet vision with the beadsman. If ceremony's due, they did aright. So she has to get the ceremony right. Does she have to in this case? I suspect Porphyro is not very picky. And if she slips up a little bit in following the ceremonial requirements, he's not going to be bothered with it. But she is committed to this. But what she's committed to is again, not the piety that St. Agnes' Feast represents, but to the promise of this romantic vision. So she has to go to bed without supper. She has to couch supine her beauty. So she has to lay down her beautiful self and not look behind or sideways, but stare fixedly ahead, looking upward to heaven once she's lying in bed for all that they desire. But her desires of heaven are again in contrast to the desires prescribed by the church. Full of this whim was thoughtful Madeline. So she is obsessing on this while she's at the feast. So Keats situates her here very carefully and is very clear about what's going on. Madeline is certainly not interested in what was going on down in the chapel. She doesn't have any thoughts of the dead in their sarcophagi, but she also is not interested in the dance that's swirling around her. It's not as though she's presented to us as a party girl who's just lost in the revelry. She's presented to us as an individual who is out of tune with all of this because of her obsessive longing to have this vision. She does not hear the music, we're told. And it's a stunning description Keats has of the music yearning like a god in pain. She scarcely heard. So this music is just achingly beautiful. Again, perhaps reminding us a little bit of Orpheus, but she doesn't notice it. Her eyes are fixed on the floor. And as they're fixed on the floor, they can't help but observe the sweeping trains of many ladies as the long trains of these ladies' dresses brush the floor as they walk past. Madeline looks at them but doesn't see them because she's looking at the floor lost in thought. And we're told that young knights, amorous cavaliers, come up to her interested in getting to know her, to use a ridiculous, banal phrase. But she doesn't notice them. And the poet says it's not because she disdains them. It's not, although that's maybe what they think. It's not that she thinks herself superior to them. It's that she's lost in her own thoughts. She's already partaking of this kind of imaginative vision that she's longing for. And so the amorous cavaliers back retired, quite like the beadsman who, you'll remember, returneth up the chapel aisle by slow degrees. You know, he goes back and they back from her. She's not bothered by them, but she just, Keats says, she saw not, her heart was otherwhere. She sighed for Agnes' dreams, the sweetness of the year. She is in that Juliet space of being in love with love, and she doesn't know how close she is to realizing that love, for good or for ill. I will stop there for this episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me. We will be back with the second part of Keats's The Eve of St. Agnes, where you'll get a little bit closer look at the story of Madeline and Porphyro. I hope you'll join us for that. So nothing remains but for me to say this is David Anderson on behalf of Eric Williams. We will be with you again soon.